Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and today we'll be joined by David Williams, who'll be telling us about Louisville's colorful gay past starting in 1953. Welcome to the show, David.
Yes, how are you doing, Art?
I'm doing great. We've already done, as you know, one segment involving some of Louisville's gay bar history. And David Dominé told us a little bit about some of the later years of Louisville's gay history. But I understand that you have quite a wealth of knowledge about Louisville's gay scene starting in the 50s.
Yes, I sure do. Yeah.
So how did you come about this knowledge? Did you live through it there in Louisville, or did you do a lot of research? How did you come to be such an expert on Louisville's gay scene?
Okay, well, in 1982, I founded the Kentucky Gay Archives, which is now known as the Williams-Nichols Collection at the University of Louisville. And I've always been an avid history buff. That was my major in college. So I naturally gravitated to doing research into local history and local gay and lesbian history. So it has come natural to me. Over the years, I've interviewed a lot of people from the LGBT community here. And they have given me insights about a lot of things that I might not have been aware of. One particular, his name was Dick, and he is now 92, but he gave me a lot of information about what gay life was like in Louisville in the 40s and 50s. So, you know, I've been gathering these interviews and doing research online, talking to people. It's just been an ongoing process for the last 25 or 30 years.
I can appreciate that. And it gets to be kind of addictive. I know with my project, I'm constantly on the lookout for more information about more of our gay bars from the past. And it's great to have people like you who have spent so much time doing this over the years. And especially in the cities that are, I would say, less well known. Mm-hmm. People think of gay in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and they think of New York City, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles. But there are amazing stories to tell from cities all over throughout the Midwest, the Southwest, everywhere in the country, the Deep South.
Mm-hmm. So, very definitely. Lexington, which is a town 75 miles from us, they have a bar that can trace its history back to about 1939. So, there's all these little stories. Louisville, before 1953, I don't know if there was any particular place in Louisville that gay men or lesbians met. I've heard stories that a lot of times the bars in the various hotels downtown were popular gathering places for gay men. And, they would often meet people from out of town and then go up to the rooms or whatever. So, going back into the earlier part of the 20th century, there was no specific gay bar or lesbian bar that I could pinpoint. It was probably a very shadowy world, very discreet. How did people meet? They just would drop hints in their conversation, stuff like, I'm a friend of Dorothy, who, of course, back then was Dorothy Parker, most likely, a columnist for The New Yorker. If some guy in a conversation said that he was a friend of Dorothy, and it was 1945, well, if the other guy picked up on that, then that was a connection that maybe they could make. But up until 1953 here in Louisville, there was no place that I know of where anybody could really meet and carry on and have, discover each other.
So what happened in 1953?
Okay, well, that going back to 1946, there was a restaurant and bar called the Beaux Arts. That's B-E-A-U-X, second word, A-R-T-S. And it started out as kind of a supper club. And it targeted mainly young business professionals who were working downtown. And these were all straight people. And that was their target audience up until about 1952, when the novelty of the place started to dwindle. And for some reason or another, the gay men in Louisville started discovering it. Maybe it's because it had this fabulous gay Paris decor on the inside with sidewalk tables and chairs and scenes from Paris. It was a very lively place for a while. As the crowd started shifting away from it, the gays moved in, mostly at night. During the day, it was still basically a straight restaurant and bar until after about 5 o'clock, 5:30. Slowly that changed over to being a gay bar, basically. Now, you say gay bar, it's not what we think of today. Even when the place was packed with gay men, the action was pretty discreet. There was no kissing, no hugging, no dancing, anything like that. It was just a place where gay men met, chatted, and hung out for a time, and then later on might go home together. There's an ad from 1952, which I've always, I just love this ad. It's from the Courier Journal in November of 1952. I don't think you can see the whole thing, but at the top it says, "Relax and be gay with Renee at the Beaux-Arts." Well, at this time, the word gay was slowly morphing from the old sense into the sense that we know today. So this doesn't necessarily mean that in November 1952, it was a gay bar. Most people would not know that gay meant homosexual back then. They were still using the gay Paris theme in the restaurant. But I always thought this was amusing, because within about a year, it really was a gay bar in the evenings. Here's a picture of the decor, which I found at the University of Louisville Archives. Very frilly, tried to make it look like a restaurant in Paris. So, that in itself attracted the gay crowd over time. So, and I can send you these photos later on. Nice. So, starting in 1953 in the evenings, it was mainly a gay crowd. And it stayed that way until the place closed at the end of 1954, beginning of 1955. At the same time, there was another bar around the corner called Gordon's Golden Horseshoe. And there again, it started out as a straight restaurant and bar. But around the same time as the Beaux-Arts was turning gay, the Gordon's was also becoming gay in the evenings. And this elderly man that I interviewed named Dick, he said that Gordon's was, yes, it was packed in the evenings on the weekends, wall-to-wall gay men. And it was a little more open, and people there did maybe hug a little bit. They didn't kiss, no dancing. But it was a very lively crowd. So we had the Beaux-Arts and the Gordon's. Starting in 1956 is what I would consider the first true gay bar in Louisville, which is the Downtowner. The Downtowner was located not very far from the Beaux-Arts and Gordon's. And from the very start, I believe that it was a gay bar where people could go, not just in the evenings, but during the day and hang out. So the Downtowner became a gay establishment in Louisville and lasted until it was torched in 1974. It was a very popular place.
Now, what was the reason for the torching? Did it have anything to do with it being a gay bar, or did it just some random accident?
Yes, no, you know, it's still an unsolved crime. It was arson, definitely. There were rumors that it was torched by the owner for the insurance. It doesn't seem like it was a hate crime. It doesn't seem like it was torched because it was a gay bar. Nobody really knows for sure. But all I know is that after it was torched, the remains, the bar, stayed there for years and years. Nobody cleaned it out. Nobody cleared the lot. For about 10 years, it was just this big hulking mass of black wood and other debris. It's still a mystery.
Now, in the 20 years that the Downtowner operated as a gay bar, or the nearly 20 years, were there other people who came into town or decided to open up other bars that would also serve the gay community when they saw that Downtowner was doing well with it?
I'm not aware of any. You know, for a long time after Beaux-Arts and Gordon's closed, Downtowner was basically the only gay bar in town, which is kind of sad because we had 300,000 people in this place at the time and only one gay bar. But this is probably typical of a lot of them and cities of our size in the country. 1959, there was a bar on Broadway not too far from the Downtowner called Ditty Moore's. And they had a back room where they performed drag shows. Now, Ditty Moore's was right across the street from the Greyhound bus station. So a lot of transients that are coming into town, they might have a few hours to kill. They would go to Ditty Moore's and have a few drinks and then get on the bus and go. As you can imagine, a lot of these people traveling through town were probably gay themselves, and they discovered the drag show in the back. But up until actually the 70s, there was really only the one bar. In downtown, there was a lesbian bar out in the suburbs called Aunt Nora's, which was in the back of a VFW hall. So, you know, a lot of the gay bar scene up until the 1970s, it was kind of like that, you know, very furtive. People knew about them, but they didn't talk about it. It was a very shadow world. You know, that, I think the straight community pretty much knew where all these places were, but they didn't really talk about it much. So that was kind of the scene up until really only about 50 years ago.
So what was the Downtowner like? What was the, was it big? Did it have a dance floor? Was it, you know, what was the general ambiance of the Downtowner?
Yeah, the Downtowner did not have a dance floor, but you walk into the bar and there was a horseshoe bar that curved around from front to back, and then there was tables where you could sit and chat. But the only thing that distinguished it from other bars, you might walk in accidentally if you were straight and think it's just a straight bar. But in the back, there was a showroom. And, you know, from about 1964, 65 on, that's where Louisville's main drag show was. So it was a pretty simple place, very dark. It was painted black. not very assuming, not all that attractive, but there was no other place that the gay people could go for a drink and chat with other gay people except for that. And it was mostly gay men. Very seldom would you see a lesbian go in there. Lesbians had Aunt Nora's out in the suburbs. And so it was not a very spectacular place, to put it mildly.
But it was your only option for almost
20 years. Yes, yeah. It was rather sad, actually, but, it is what it is.
So what happened in the 70s that you started to see more activity in the gay scene there?
Well, one word, baby boomers. with all these baby boomers running around and discovering their sexuality and realizing that there was only one bar in town to go to, then eventually other people stepped forward and opened their own bars. The big bar, one of the most consequential gay bars, opened on Derby Eve, 1973, May 4th, 1973, and that was called the Badlands Territory. The Badlands Territory was actually a chain of two bars. The other bar was in Cincinnati. And so the people that owned the bar in Cincinnati came to Louisville, saw an opportunity, and opened the Badlands Territory. And it quickly became very popular. It's my coming out bar. 9 days after it opened, I walked into the place for the first time. I'd never been to a gay bar in my life before then. And it was a step up from the downtowner. It was painted nicely. It had some nice decor to it. One of the more famous, there was four rooms. And one of the rooms was painted like a Victorian whorehouse with red velvet wallpaper. It looked like something off of a steamboat from the 19th century or something. And it had a fabulous jukebox. It played all the great hits of the day. So quickly became a very, very popular bar. And it's all because of the baby boomer generation. There's just tons of us showing up with no place to go. So these people saw the opportunity and they made the most of it. It later became known as the Discovery back in 1981 or 82. About 1977, when Saturday Night Fever came out, the Badlands became the first gay bar in the town to have a lighted dance floor. Now, before that, they had had a small dance floor in the back. I guess you could consider it Louisville's first gay dance floor. This was about 1973, 74. But 77 and 78 with John Travolta, everybody in the country had to have a lighted dance floor. So they put one up on the second floor, which I hear is still there. It was just wildly popular. You can just imagine. At the same time, Studio 54 was opening in New York. And so I think they were trying to emulate Studio 54 in a small way, in a small town America way, with this dance floor. And it had mirrors on the wall and disco balls and all that stuff. So it was a very wild place, actually. Just about anything went on.
Now, being your first gay bar experience, what was it like for you to walk into a gay bar for the first time and see something as nice as Badlands was? Were you surprised? Were you shocked? Or did you What impact did that have on you when you walked in there the first time?
Okay, well, basically, I had to be dragged into the place. By that time, I'd been out of the Army for about a year, and I slowly was discovering the gay underground in Louisville and made a few friends. And so these two friends of mine, I kept telling them, I enjoy meeting men and going around and dating and having fun, but you will never see me walk into a gay bar at all. Never, ever. Well, one time Dennis and this friend of his, we went to a movie at the cinemas. Afterwards, I was living in the suburbs, and I thought, well, okay, we'll go home after this. Well, they didn't take me home. They got up on the expressway and went into town and got off and drove over to Main Street, which is where the Badlands was. And I kind of knew what they were doing. I said, oh, God, they're not doing this. They are not taking me into a gay bar. But I didn't have much choice. I was sitting in the back seat. They were driving. So we got out and went in. And it was a Sunday night. Not very many people there. And I was shocked. I was kind of petrified, actually. Well, the next week, I was back there three times. it didn't take me very long. Today I liken it to having a born-again experience. I like to tell people I was not born until the age of 26 on May 13th, 1973. After that, Badlands became my home bar, my home territory. I looked forward to going there every Saturday night and dancing and meeting men and chatting and having fun and laughing. And it was a whole new experience, considering that I had been raised such a strict Catholic back in the 50s and 60s. I felt like I had finally found my home.
I think that the gay bar experience for a lot of us was like that. My first experience was in 77, and it gave you suddenly a realization that there was a community out there. Because prior to that, as you mentioned in your own life, very often it was a very small handful of close friends who knew that you were gay and most likely were also gay. And you thought that was about the extent of the gay world. You didn't know that there was this big community out there. So it must have been kind of heartwarming to walk into a bar of that size and see that many other people that you could relate to in your own hometown.
Oh, yes. I felt very welcome. Up until the 60s and 70s, and gay life in Louisville and pretty much everywhere outside of New York and San Francisco was like that. It was just the small groups of friends, cliques, people knew people when they hung out. They went to the beach on the weekends, maybe. This is Library Circle. Library Circle was where a lot of people in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and even into the 80s, there was a driveway in front of the public library downtown. And everybody knew that if you wanted to pick up somebody, you went to Library Circle. It was kind of sad, but that's all that people knew about. This is from a photo album that somebody gave us a couple of years ago. This was kind of like, this was emblematic of gay life in Louisville and pretty much everywhere until the 70s. Just small groups of men finding each other somehow, hanging out, having fun, and sharing their secret, not letting anybody else know that they were never going to marry, they were never going to have kids. I like this one. This is from the same photo album. These four guys sitting on a beach somewhere, just camping it up with heels in the air. again, you know, just small groups of men, you know, very discreet, very shadowy.
What a lot of people don't realize is that those pictures seem very tame right now, but back in the day, you know, in the 50s and 60s, if that group of four men from the beach were seen on the beach, even without heels or anything, they would have gotten a lot of double takes. If they went to a restaurant for dinner together, just the four of them, they would get a lot of double takes because they weren't women.
Yeah, you know, it would have seemed really odd, you know. It's kind of a paranoid existence. You had to keep watching your back, looking over your shoulder. If you tried to talk about your life, you had to make sure that nobody else was around that you didn't know. You know, you could literally be thrown into jail.
And I think that might be why back in the earlier days of, you know, this conversation, the 50s, 60s, 70s, a lot of gay men used terms like Mary when they were on the phone talking about their friends, because they wanted any coworkers or casual listeners to think that they were speaking to or about a woman. Uh-huh. They wouldn't know that you were talking to Ralph about going to dinner that night. You were, "Hey, Mary, you want to go to dinner tonight?"
Oh yeah,
it was a cover. It was a total facade.
Well, I think that's where the term "friend of Dorothy" came in. You know, it's the different ideas about where that came from. But Dorothy Parker used to write tons of letters to GIs when they were overseas in the army fighting Hitler and Hirohito. And you know, since there is this theory that that's where the term "friend of Dorothy" came up, you know. So after the war, of course, you could say if somebody asked who that friend of yours was, you might say, "Oh, he's a friend of Dorothy." Well, this straight person probably didn't know what you were talking about, but if they were gay, they probably pretty much knew.
So how long did Badlands last there? You said it in 81, it changed to Discovery?
Yes, it became the Discovery. It's not a very good photograph, but this photograph is from about 1982 or something. It was very nondiscreet. There was no lights out front telling you that there was a bar there, but everybody knew what it was. And this is iconic for a lot of Louisville gay baby boomers. You know, this entrance here, it was very familiar.
Now, it looks like they have kind of a generic globe over the doorway with the word "Discovery" in it. Was that the extent of their signage?
There was no signage, nothing. Now, Discovery lasted all the way up to about 1990. In its later years, the gay crowd started moving away as more bars opened up. The last time I walked into the place, it was kind of a straight punk bar. So, you know, it ran its course about the late 1980s. But in the meantime, after the downtowner burned in 1974, drag queens and some other people who were associated with it decided to open a new place on Main Street just down from the Badlands, and they called it the New Downtowner. The New Downtowner is also another iconic bar here in Louisville. Now, the Discovery was almost exclusively gay men. You might have lesbians come in, you might have drag queens, but it was mostly a gay male meeting place. Downtowner was everybody. Everybody came in. And, you know, straight, some straight people, but mostly gays, lesbians, transgenders. It was a very open place. Again, the Downtowner, which I think I have, this isn't. again, this is right after it closed. This is an old whiskey warehouse that had been turned into this bar, the Downtowner, in 1974. And to look at it, you know, there's not much to look at. They had a sign out front that said the Downtowner, but that was it. But it was three floors. Who knows what happened on the fourth floor. But the second floor was a bar. I think the third floor was a bar. And again, it attracted just about everybody. And they had a very lively drag show in the back. The show was called The Fabulous Fakes. And an awful lot of drag queens got their start at that drag show at the back room of the Downtowner, including one who is still going strong. Her name is Lee Shannon, and she's kind of the big star in Orlando right now. There was other drag queens that was the place to go on Saturday nights. It was a very lively scene. They had eventually a small dance floor. It was a very narrow space, one room deep all the way back. So they could not put in a large dance floor like they did at the Badlands, but they had their nice dance floor. Everybody had to have one. And I remember dancing on it one time, and I was a little tipsy and dancing so vigorously that I fell off the edge of the stage and into this lesbian's arms. Oh, probably time for me to go home. But it was a very solid place up until 1989. And that's when it closed and it became The Connection a few blocks down.
Now, The Connection is a rather impressive and iconic gay bar for anywhere in the country, but particularly in Louisville.
Yes.
I never visited the Louisville one, but I have been to the one they opened in Nashville a number of times, and they did not hold anything back. What was your impression when The Connection opened in Louisville? How did that change the scene in Louisville as far as the club scene was concerned? What was the general reaction to it?
Well, it was over the top. I mean, they claimed that they were the second largest LGBT bar in the country. There was only one that was larger, and that was in Los Angeles somewhere. So it was a huge place, and they had a huge stage. Back at the old Downtowner, the stage was, I don't want to say a large living room, but it was rather small. The stage at The Connection was professional. It had spotlights, it had a curtain, it had a runway, it had cabaret-style seating, it had balconies. It was glittering. There was disco balls everywhere. Disco balls, by the way, are made in Louisville. Mirrors, you know, it was just a very flashy place. The dance floor was huge. Probably, you know, the dance floor is probably as big as the entire original Downtowner Chestnut. So it was kind of it kind of blew out all the stitches. For a while, there was also a leather bar there. There was a patio bar. It made the owners very wealthy.
Yeah, the one in Nashville was very much like that. They had a country western bar. They had a patio bar. Mm-hmm. They had a huge auditorium for their performances with a very professional stage and runway.
Yeah, it was the same owners.
Yeah, and they had a gigantic gift shop. I don't think I'd ever seen a gift shop in a gay bar.
Yeah.
That. You could pretty much do all your shopping there.
And also I forgot to mention this place for a time had a restaurant called Julian's.
And that was in the Connection.
Julian's was named for, there's two owners, George and Eddie, and they adopted a son who they named Julian, and so they named their restaurant after him. So that's all in the family.
Now, you mentioned briefly that Louisville is known for disco balls, and yeah. I discussed that to some extent when I interviewed David Domine, and I know you know David. The topic came up because he had named his book, A Dark Room in Glitterball City. And so when I was talking to him about it, I was like, well, why would you call Louisville Glitterball City? And I learned that the Myriad Reflector, I believe is what it was called originally, was actually invented in Kentucky. And then there was a very large company there that I believe still operates on some level, manufacturing some of the finest mirror balls or disco balls in the country.
Yes.
And that's something a lot of people would not associate with Louisville.
No, it's really, really strange. You know, there's a lot of things about Louisville that people are surprised about. It's a quirky city in some ways, like Austin. But the disco ball factory is still going strong in the eastern part of downtown Louisville. And they make about 85-90% of all the disco balls. They keep complaining about all these new disco balls coming in from China, how cheap they are, and that the mirrors keep falling off of them and stuff like that. So chances are, if you do get a disco ball, it's from Louisville.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting designation to have, but it's a big part of our history. You know, that I've been to many bars that had very impressive disco balls, and I understand that Louisville right now is in the process of trying to raise some money to build the world's largest disco ball.
Yes, that's kind of weird, kind of wild.
I wonder what they'll do with it, because I understand the goal is to make one that is a 60-foot diameter, which means it would be larger than most office buildings downtown.
Yeah, I think they were talking about putting it at Waterfront Park downtown, but I don't know. I haven't heard much lately.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
So Connections opened and kind of blew everybody out of the water.
Yes.
They just made this huge impression, not only on Louisville, but I imagine there were people that were traveling from several hours away on the weekends to go to that bar.
Yes. Well, you know, what was really odd, you know, up until about that time, gay bars were still basically meant for gays and lesbians and transgenders, bisexuals. Starting in the 90s, you see a lot of straight people, especially straight women, going into the Connection. They liked it mainly because of the dance floor. It was just a fabulous dance floor. I mean, you could get lost on it. So it, up until about 1990, it was really odd to see straight people in a gay bar in Louisville. You start seeing them filtering in around that time, and so that was good for our community. It was good for our image, you know, having a bar where, you know, you just wanted to have fun. It wasn't anything menacing, just nothing sinister about it, as people in the straight world might think. So it was quite a phenomenon. It lasted till, I think, 2015.
Yeah, and I think, did they knock the building down finally?
Oh, yes. You know, it was sold. It's now a hotel. It's a boutique hotel, which is kind of sad. But the thing about there was a lot of other gay bars and lesbian bars in Louisville from the 70s through the 90s and beyond. And the Connection spawned the downtowner and the connection spawned a lot of these bars because they showed up at the same places. Traditionally, gay bars and lesbian bars sprouted up in the seedier parts of town, places where nobody wanted to go at night, which was convenient because the gay people ironically felt more safe going to these places. There was Murphy's Place, there was the Odyssey, there was Tinkers and Tinkers 2, which are lesbian bars. They all kind of stayed around the same area as the downtown or in the connection, which was East Downtown. East Downtown at that time was just dead at night. It was just abandoned warehouses, factories that closed down at 6 o'clock. Just what you might expect of a waterfront area. But it was very popular. Gay people and lesbians felt safe going there at night. Murphy's Place was one of the more popular ones. It was a very typical old time place with this fabulous Victorian wood bar in the back. It was a very lively scene. I think in 1995, I counted 9 or 10 gay and lesbian bars, which when you think of New York, that's nothing. But in a city the size of Louisville, that was pretty much, there was a lot of activity going on.
It sounds like it was a pretty hopping place.
Oh, yes. Yeah, very much so. Later on, there was also a bar called Triangles, which was kind of spawned up in the shadow of the connection. It was mainly a gay male bar, and it stayed open till last year, I think it closed. If you're living in Kentucky and you're gay, lesbian, Louisville was the only place to go on a Saturday night, or Lexington also. Word got out to all these tiny little towns in Western Kentucky and Eastern Kentucky, about the connection, I have found that when I was growing up, the way I found out about gay life in Louisville was from my straight friends or even from my mother. My mother warned me once, oh, don't go to this part of Cherokee Park. Stay away from there. I put two and two together. I thought, oh, I wonder what's going on in that part of Cherokee Park. or you might have a straight friend say, yeah, oh, don't go to the downtowner. That's where the queer people go. You might not even have heard of the downtowner before that. So later on that night, you might show up at the door. Straight friends were a great way of finding out about gay life in small towns like ours.
Yeah, I've heard that from other people I've interviewed. One woman I interviewed was, a college basketball player, and she was on the bus going somewhere for a game. And the bus driver warned them, don't go over to this place. That's a lesbian bar. Yeah. So of course, that's where they went. I've heard that before, and it's, it was that, and it was a limited availability if you stumbled across a Dameron's guide, which, you could occasionally pick up if you knew what to look for. And I know when I would travel back then, you would find one or two places in the city you were going to. And then, of course, it just mushrooms because you go into that one place and say, hey, where are the other bars? It kind of opened the door for you.
Yeah, I call it the velvet underworld.
Uh-huh. So after you had all these fabulous experiences with gay nightlife in Louisville and realized that there was a community out there, what kind of inspired you to start the Kentucky Gay Archives? What made you think that was something that was needed?
Well, actually, it started in 1982. Before 1982, Louisville had very little LGBT political activity. It was kind of pop up here and there, but nothing would come of it. A group would be formed and then it would disintegrate. But in 1982 is when everything started forming. There was a lot of different groups starting up. This was as a result of a man named Sam Doar, who passed away recently. He was the branch manager of the bank in Louisville, and he became president of Dignity, which was a Catholic gay and lesbian group. And he told his bosses at the bank that he might be appearing on TV from time to time to talk about gay issues. Well, initially they were okay with it, but then they came back a couple of weeks later and said, no, you can't be doing this, you know. So they made an ultimatum. It was either the bank or him, and he was basically forced to resign. This caused a big stink among a lot of his friends here in Louisville. So in 1982, people just started forming all these different groups. There was gay nurses group, gay discussion groups, and we had had MCC for a while, but during that time, 1982 to 84, there was like 17 or 20 different groups that started up. And I got involved. I was with this gay men's social group, and there was a coalition group called GLUE, Gays and Lesbians United for Equality. And they were wanting representatives from every group in town to come to their coalition meetings once a month. And somehow I got volunteered. So that was my entree into gay and lesbian activism. That November, I decided there was a lot of stuff floating around, a lot of flyers, newsletters. People started making buttons and things. So I thought, you know, being of an historical mind, being a history major in college, I'd never used it. You know, what can you do with history except teach it or write about it? So I thought, well, you know, we need to be saving some of this stuff for future generations. So basically it was all the activism from 1982 and 83 that started me on this path to developing this archive and library. And we believe it's now one of the 10 largest in the country.
Now, when you started it, it was a grassroots effort. It was a one-man team with a few friends just collecting things. And now it's grown into something under the auspices, I guess, of the University of Louisville. It's been adopted by the University of Louisville, and it's actually a large archive collection.
You know, we have about 7,000 books, 35,000 magazines and newspapers, bumper stickers, buttons, placards, protest posters, records, you name it. And we probably got it down there.
And mostly focusing on Louisville and Kentucky gay history, correct?
The core of it is, Louisville and Kentucky. But, you know, we have newspapers and magazines from everywhere. We have newspapers from Thailand and Italy. So it's kind of an international, more or less. But we have an awful lot of the early gay newspapers from New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco.
Very cool. I am so glad there are people like you out there who have been doing this for that long, because, you know, it occurred to me when I started my project that there was so little preserved about the history of our bar scene, which was so important to being able to form all these groups. And so many of the nonprofits that we have were supported in one way or another by the bars, or they held their meetings at the bars and found their followers, or they did fundraising events at the bars. And it occurred to me that so little of that had been preserved. And so I'm really grateful that someone like you and the people like you all over the country have done this for their own communities and really, you know, started a collection that will save the stories of what happened before we had the internet.
Oh yeah, before the internet. That changed everything. But
sure did.
Yeah, you know, a lot of these archives and libraries started with just one or a few people. The Ohio Lesbian Archives is a huge archive in Cincinnati. It started out with just a very few people. And there's the Chris Gonzalez Archives up in Indianapolis, which is now part of the public library system up there. It was just started by this Chris Gonzalez up there in Indianapolis. I think everywhere you go around the country, it's just a few people who were like-minded, historic-minded people who just saw the need and started it. I think the Stonewall Library in Fort Lauderdale is the same way. Another thing is that most of these libraries and archives started at about the same time, around 1980, the late 70s. Of course, before that, there was a lot of activism. But it wasn't really as exploding until 78, 79, 80. So I think it was just kind of at the right time and the right place for a lot of these archives. There's probably about 60 archives all told around the country now.
Yeah, I think part of it was, you know, after Stonewall, people were starting to get more embracing their gay history and their, you know, the stories of things that happened in the gay community. And I think also as you moved into the 70s, you kind of had that general free love movement, that kind of hippie scene that was more open-minded. And mm-hmm. I think the combination of those factors, people started to kind of focus on preserving things from our past and putting them in a context where they would be preserved for a long time. Because before that, if you had a personal collection, it was stashed at the bottom of your closet. And mm-hmm. when you passed away, a friend of yours, hopefully, would sneak over to your place and pull it out and throw it in the trash before your parents or siblings came and took your belongings, because it was a big secret. So it definitely changed things, but it's a great thing that there are people like you that have done that.
Well, you know, a personal impetus for me was growing up in the 50s and 60s and learning that I was gay. Of course, you naturally want to start looking around at the library or wherever you can find any information about this thing that you didn't really understand. You go to the library and you can't find anything. The only thing you might find is going into these psychological tomes and looking up homosexuality, and they were almost always condemnatory. And you think, oh, this is no good. And, you know, I know I'm better than this. But there was very little information about homosexuality that I knew of personally, a little kid in a southern city in America. I didn't know where to turn to find out anything. So as I grew into an adult in the 70s and started going out, I realized, you know, there's a lot more to us than what you find in some dusty book at the library. So that was another impetus that I had for starting the archives.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned earlier that there's only a couple of things that you can do with a history degree. And you commented that one of them was writing a book. And you have a book out called Secrets of Old Louisville.
Oh, yes. Well, that's not a gay book, but yes.
Right. And that's talking about, I'm guessing, the more interesting, spicy elements of Louisville history.
Yes. Well, Old Louisville is the name of a part of Louisville. It's a 45 square blocks filled with all these grand and Victorian and Edwardian mansions. So that's a term that you will hear if you ever come to Louisville. And the book I wrote was basically about all the little known facts about the neighborhood. And I, of course, I have one chapter in there about the gay history of the neighborhood. So, it's a, kind of an interesting thing that I did 4 years ago.
Yeah, and one of those little tidbits of gay history from the neighborhood involves the murder of a drag queen.
Oh, yes.
Which happened in old Louisville.
Yeah, the David Dominy, that's the focus of his book, yes.
So
that was quite a story for 2 or 3 years here, yeah.
I can imagine.
Pardon?
I said I can imagine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it had everything, drugs, sex, and stuffing a body in the basement, and,
That's an interesting character.
You kind of laugh, you can find a little laughter at some of it. It wasn't very funny to the guy that got killed, but there's some real black humor to it.
Now, was that a really big deal when you were living through the actual experience, when the trial was going on, when the news was covering it? Did it impact mm-hmm. your life in any way, or was it just, oh, that's something that happened over in old Louisville?
Yeah, I was living in old Louisville, a couple of blocks away. But, it was probably good that murder took place in 2009. If it had taken place in 1979, it would have been really devastating to the gay and lesbian community because we were still very much in the closet, very shadowy. People, looked with disdain upon us. By 2009, people's attitudes have been changing dramatically towards gays and lesbians. So I think the community of Louisville looked upon it as just what it was, a murder. It wasn't a gay murder. It was a murder, very salacious, very scandalous. But so it didn't have the impact on the local community that it might have had 30 years earlier.
Well, that definitely puts it into perspective. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk about some of these old bars from Louisville. And I would encourage anybody who is who's listening to this to do a little bit of research, to use the University of Louisville resources at the Williams Nichols Archives, and to investigate a little bit more, find out a little bit more about the colorful gay history that Louisville has had since the 1950s. I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you, David.
Well, thank you very much. Really enjoyed it.
That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show. For more information about this episode or to find more episodes, visit gaybarchives.com.